All right, everybody, welcome to the Sports Inquirer podcast. This is your host, Emar Soportsoot. Let's go over all of our sponsors and what's going to be talked about today on the show. Once again, we are always brought to you by SportsInquirer.net's premier news website for the world of sports. Obviously, always good content there as far as mixed martial arts, good college football recap of what happened in the Alabama-Virginia Tech game, and other additional content will be on there later this week, I believe. We're going to have the NFL predictions up as well as college football recap and MMA power rankings, which will be written this weekend by yours truly. So look forward to seeing all of that content. We are also brought to you by the startinglineup.net, the one of another premier site for news and notes in sports, and a live audio broadcast takes place in Chicago every week. A matter of fact, I think there's going to be a recording this Saturday at a cigar bar in Chicago. And go to thestartinglineup.net, all one word. There'll be plenty of information on that live recording from Chicago. Really good content there as well. On today's show, we're going to start off reviewing the week in college football with our triple option attack. Next, we're going to go into our mixed martial arts power rankings, which will tie into a recap of UFC 164 in our verbal submission section. NFL time is upon us. Opening kickoff is tomorrow. So in our zone blitz portion of the show, we're going to preview the NFL, a lot of predictions, analysis, and what we expect to see over the next coming months. Spreading the field, general news and notes in the world of sports, we'll get into that. And then finally, in the return of the Ruffling My Feathers section, we're going to see why self-portraits or selfies have been a bane of existence for me, or issues, for quite a while. So once again, welcome to the Inquirer podcast. Let's start the show. Welcome to the show once again. Emarcel Portsoot is your host. Had a really good Labor Day weekend. Was able to get some relaxation in, as well as cover some tremendous content in the world of college football. All right, let's turn the mic up a little bit. Let's get that going. Matter of fact, I just love doing live edits while the show is going on. Let's see if they can get audio. There we go. That seems a little better. All right, now we're talking. All right, so once again, welcome to the show. And the weekend was quite interesting because I had a football game on Friday night that I covered. Went over to Pebblebrook versus Southwest DeKalb. The Falcons pulled off a major upset within the world of Georgia high school football. Able to witness that first win in about a year for the Falcons over a pretty solid Southwest DeKalb team. But after that, on Saturday, I actually covered the Alabama-Virginia Tech contest as a media member, which is definitely a major honor for me. Much respect and thank yous to the Chick-fil-A Bowl committee for giving me the media pass. And the way it's worked over the past few years is I've developed a relationship with them. I'm one of those guys, I would wear those polo shirts and assist with the press box as far as setup, assisting media members, getting post-game quotes and all that stuff. So while I did my pregame activities with them, as usual, I was actually able to sit down and watch the game and do a lot of live tweeting, which a few of you actually complimented me on and said that you saw them throughout the contest. Really appreciate that as well. The support is always welcomed on my side of things. So I went to the game. Interesting tidbits from it. I think because of, well, two factors in what I'm about to say. The interest was high because it was Alabama in the contest, and Virginia Tech is a respectable program as well with Frank Beamer and what they've done in the past 20, 30 years. But it felt like the buzz was a little bit down in comparison to other years that I've worked, the bowl game and even the kickoff classic. think two reasons for that. One, you had a lot of competition in the game as far as other contests going on. And maybe because I was in Georgia, and that's point number two. But point number one is I think the competition among all of the preseason kickoff classics. And I go back to being growing up in New York City and seeing the kickoff classic at the Meadowlands or New Jersey back in the 80s and early 90s. I remember seeing Syracuse in the game, Southern California, Georgia Tech was in the game, Penn State, they made a few appearances. And that used to be the only game in town as far as a kickoff classic. And then they started going away because some teams were getting 12 contests in while others were getting 11. It was unfair. But since that, they've developed the 12-game standard regular season, not counting conference championships and bowl games for all teams in the FBS division. You're starting to see a lot of these other games. Chick-fil-A was the first to really revitalize it. And now New Jersey actually had, with the new MetLife Stadium, they have a contest. It was Syracuse and Penn State. Houston has a game now. Dallas has a contest. So you're starting to see a lot more teams do it. So I think that was one thing that kind of eliminated the buzz from it. Second thing was being within Georgia and having the Georgia Bulldogs playing Clemson Tigers right after the game. You saw a lot of guys trying to rush to get their deadline or write their story before the deadline so they can sit and watch the game. And the game itself really didn't help that much. Biggest things I noticed from it, and we'll get to it right now. I put it out on a tweet. Alabama, for as college football goes, maybe the biggest team that I've ever seen up close. Now, I'm pretty sure you've seen maybe an offensive line from Wisconsin or maybe another SEC team have a lot of beef to it, and that's fine and everything. But they were above average in every single position as far as size goes. And I'm talking from Yeldon as a running back, 6'2", I think 200-plus pounds. Linebackers, 250, 260 pounds. Even the cornerbacks, 5'11", 6-foot solid, 200-plus pound guys. You didn't see too many 5'7 or 5'8 cornerbacks in there. And then the beef on the offensive and defensive lines. Physically, the most impressive team that I've seen as far as a college goes. I'm not counting NFL. Those are really grown men. That's a different entity, different animal. But really in that contest, the biggest factor was Virginia Tech making a lot of mistakes. The special teams were very disappointing. I think you saw the end of the Beamer ball era. And looking in their media guide, you saw a page dedicated just to Beamer ball, the special teams, defensive touchdowns. That's really fallen off over the past few seasons, and that game really proved it. A lot of talk about the Alabama offensive line and the problems that they had against Virginia Tech defense. First of all, the Hokies have a very excellent defensive front seven. They're going to be a force in the ACC. Outside of Florida State and Clemson, the rest of the conference is wide open, and I think the Hokies can definitely put together an 8-9 win season just on that alone. Offensively, they have a lot of struggles. Logan Thomas, who 2 years ago going into his junior year, was considered a major factor as far as being a first-round NFL draft pick. He has not improved in two seasons. You've seen a regression completely in his play. You saw a lot of missed passes, a lot of confusion as far as what he needed to do with the ball in the pocket, and you cannot have that from your fifth-year senior. And then overall, I think Alabama just methodically was able to get things done. You didn't see a lot of rushing yards from them. Cooper had a few solid catches offensively for Alabama, but overall it was a really workman-efficient effort for them. I don't do college polls until week 3 or 4 of the season. The reason I don't do that is, one, a lot of these teams are still in the early stages, and I want to get a good look at every team, preferably two contests before I start doing a power poll or ranking them based on where I think they stack up against their competition around the nation. So I'm not going to go into Alabama's number one or Clemson moved into my top 4 or 5. When I do my first rankings, those would definitely be factors of seeing those games. But I like to hold off on that because usually by game 2 or 3, most of these teams will play a solid opponent, and that's why I'm going to hold off on that. Here are my general thoughts on the SEC contest that took place this weekend. I watched the South Carolina game just like all of you. Lay off Jadeveon Clowney. I'm not saying you should be sympathetic to him and give him a pat on the back or hug him. He's a grown man. That's not the issue. The man still had a tremendous impact on the entire contest just by his presence of being on the field. Sure, he may have taken a playoff or two or whatever you consider that, of not maybe pursuing a play completely. I have not seen a defensive lineman, and I'm talking about all the great ones of the past, the current ones presently in the NFL doing their thing, or even in the future, go hard every single play. Now, you hear stories about different guys saying, man, he has an unlimited motor. He goes hard all the time. That's not the case. So, as someone who actually played football, played a little bit defensive line, it is darn near impossible to go 100% the entire contest. Now, that's not an excuse for you not to perform and execute all the time and do your job during every snap. But there are times where you're going to rush. But if you know the play is not going your way, you're going to back off a little bit. And I saw some of that with Clowney. Also, I know about the stomach virus and it being really humid out there. He was still double-teamed constantly. Plays were avoided towards him. And even though North Carolina, they actually did one thing. We'll get to that in the preview, when I preview the South Carolina-Georgia game. They did do some interesting things, North Carolina offensively, that may slow him down a little bit. And we'll get to that during the preview. But lay off of him. He's still an elite player. He's going to have a lot of good contest. And with defensive linemen, it's not always about getting the sacks. It's about putting pressures. And even game playing against you is part of your effectiveness as a defensive lineman. So lay off of him. I think Mississippi is going to beat one of the big three teams in the West. And the big three are Alabama, LSU, and Texas A&M. Yes, I did watch the entire game against Vanderbilt, my alma mater, and we'll get to the Commodores in a moment. But I like what I saw from Mississippi in several factors. One, the offense is going to put up a lot of points. I like Bo Wallace, the freshman wide receiver. They are going to put up a lot of points and give teams trouble on that side of the ball. Are they going to win the West? No. But do they have a potential to be an 8-9 win team? That might be a little bit of a stretch as well, just looking at the stiff competition. But they are going to they're going to beat one of those big three teams. And I know they get Alabama at home, and I believe they're on the road at Texas A&M and at LSU. I need to get the schedule in front of me, but I think they're going to knock off one of those three teams and affect that side of the race. Going over to the Vanderbilt side, I think they're going to beat one of the big three teams in the SEC East. And I consider those Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. I like what I saw from the Commodores offensively with Jordan Matthews. Really valiant effort from him. He got sick towards the end of the game but kept going. I like Carter Samuels offensively. They're going to put up points defensively. I thought they did an okay job. And it's kind of odd because Vanderbilt's calling card the past few years has been on the defensive end. But I thought the defense let them down towards the end. Obviously that big run at the end of the game to really lose the contest. But I think Vanderbilt still has a chance to be an 8-win team, and they're going to knock off one of those teams. They get South Carolina on the road. They host Georgia. I think that's definitely ripe for the picking. And in Florida, they go to the Swamp. And they've actually competed well against Florida and Swamp over the past few games they've played there. So I think you're going to definitely see some of that. Man, Kentucky still has a ways to go. It's one thing to lose to Western Kentucky and Bobby Petrino, and that's become a solid program over the past 2-3 seasons. Willie Taggart did a very good job rebuilding that program, really rising that program in an FBS level. And Petrino is taking that talent and putting it to another level. I like Mark Stoops. I like what he's doing there at Kentucky as far as trying to gain the talent. But that was a game they really, really, really needed to win in Nashville. One, it's a non-conference game against opponent that you believe you should be at least equal to. So those losses hurt because you know how tough the SEC is going to be. Just from a pride standpoint, Western Kentucky can now say they've won two consecutive games, football-wise, against the Wildcats. That is really tough to deal with in-state. Much less about the recruiting, because Kentucky, in the end, should be able to out-recruit Western Kentucky. Bowling Green's a fun place, very convenient, close to Nashville, actually closer to Nashville than Kentucky as far as university goes, but you still cannot lose that game in state because you know Louisville is going to get you later on in the next few weeks. You just need that for your pride as far as in-state goes. So that was a really bad deal for them. And then finally with Georgia with the Bulldogs in an odd position. I really thought they should have won that contest against Clemson. Really went away from the running game. Gurley was doing very well. Marshall had some nice runs. But Gurley, I think, only got the ball 12 or 13 times rushing. That's too few touches for him. He has to touch the ball more. And it was one of those games where, and we'll get to the Clemson side of it, but from Georgia, you knew the defense was going to struggle a little bit just because of the youth on there. But if you look at the past few games that the Bulldogs have played, and yes, granted, it's been against top competition, but they have really shown some struggles on that side of the ball. You look at the Alabama game, giving up 200-plus yards rushing, SEC title game last year. Even their bowl game, they gave up a lot of running yards in that contest. And then you look at the Clemson game on Saturday. And while the Tigers have an excellent offense, Taj Boyd looks like he's made that step from solid college quarterback to maybe the top quarterback in the nation potentially. And Sammy Watkins, he's a special talent as well. But you still have to find a way to win that contest when you have the talent advantage at certain points, especially on the offensive end. And then also seeing Malcolm Mitchell with that leg injury, with the celebration. I hope it ends that jump right there that everyone does at the end of every touchdown, every defensive stop. While it's not going to end it, these guys, young guys, even professional guys, you see them jumping up and down. It's just a stupid play, useless. It's the same thing I always say with baseball. Every time there's a game-winning home run or the walk-off home run, whatever you want to call it, and you see all of the guys jumping up and down in a pile at the home plate after the win when the guy with the home run scores the final run. Pointless and stupid to potentially get injured over something like that. But going back to Georgia being in an odd position, their first two games at Clemson, home against South Carolina this Saturday, as a fan, you want to win both. But if you're going to lose one, the Clemson game is probably the one that you could lose. I think they're going to beat South Carolina on Saturday. I think the momentum, well, not the momentum, but the energy from being home, I think they're going to realize that while Clowney is going to be a major issue on that side of the ball, if they run the ball, control the clock, they, I think, have a better chance of scoring more points than South Carolina against Georgia's defense. So I think that if they lose the game to South Carolina, I've not been in that camp of firing Mark Richt and eliminating him. When you win 9-10 games a season, that's really tough to say no to. But if you look around the landscape of the SEC, LSU's won a national title since he's been at Georgia. Alabama's won 3. Shoot, even Tennessee's gotten a national title since then. Auburn's gotten 1. You look at all of the teams that have, Florida has their 2. You look at all of the teams around your contemporaries winning a crystal ball, and you're not, and you've had the same guy, and you're churning out NFL caliber talent every single year. It's disappointing as a fan to see that. So I completely understand the Georgia fans having issues with Richt, but I don't think he's going to get fired unless it's a complete disaster, like a 3-8 Gene Chizik type season, and I don't see that happening with the Bulldogs. So we'll see what happens with Georgia on Saturday. Quick notes about the ACC. Calm the Florida State talk about them being back. Seems like for the past 10 years, even back towards Ballin's end run and Jimbo Fisher since he's been there, every year Florida State is back. They can contend for the national title. Pump your brakes on that. Win the ACC first, potentially play for a national title, and then we can start talking about Florida State being back. I don't think the young generation or even my contemporaries in their mid-30s, as far as age goes, realize how significant Florida State was back in the, I think, late 80s throughout the entire 90s. They finished in the top 4 in the rankings, I believe 12 or 13 consecutive seasons. Winning a road game against an inferior Pittsburgh team, trust me, James Winston, I'm on the train. I'm on the bandwagon. He is a tremendous talent. I think he has a chance to have a special season. But when you say they're back, being back is being a national title contender. Florida State is not there yet. Can they get there? Of course they can. They have the resources, the talent, the fan base, the money to make that happen. But they are not back yet. Now, are they back to being a contender for a conference title? Absolutely. And they should be. And that leads me to Clemson as well. People saying Clemson is a national title contender as well, as they should be. How many ACC titles do you think Clemson has won in the past 30 seasons? Now, we're talking about the Clemson, Danny Ford, the Perry brothers, all of the legendary South Carolina, the legendary talent and the SEC attention as far as fan base, the money, the resources, everything you can think of as far as Clemson goes. How many ACC titles, which quite honestly has been an inferior conference to the SEC, Big Ten, even the Pac-12, and the Big 12 at various points throughout the past 30 years? Two. They've won two ACC titles since 1990. And Dabo does have one back in 2011, so he gets credit for that. But let's pump the brakes on Clemson. Like, they have the resume to be considered a national title contender on what they've done. Let's let them win the ACC also, and then we'll see what happens. But I think they do have a chance to have a special season. If they get past Florida State, and then they get past South Carolina at the last game of the regular season, they're going to Pasadena. They're going to be in a national title game. And they're going to win the ACC title as well. But let's hold off on saying that they are going to be an elite team. But I like what I'm seeing, and they have a chance to be good. Finally, on the ACC, didn't learn much from the layup games. Georgia Tech, Elon, Wake Forest, and Presbyterian, Duke, NC Central. I understand why you have to play these games in some ways. You like to have your one, I guess, Patsy or your FCS team. We'll get to some of the FCS teams. It was a big week for them. But I don't like having that as the beginning game of your season. If you want to have it towards the fourth or fifth week and have it on your homecoming, I kind of get that. You want to get a win maybe midpoint in the season and get the momentum going. I don't like it in the very beginning of the year. If I was an AD, I would still have that game because the incentive to have that one home contest where you know you're most likely going to win is too much to ignore. But you come off the off season, anticipations are high, everyone's been training hard and working hard, and you face Elon or you face North Carolina Central. And we're focusing on the ACC, and I'm not picking on those teams in particular. You saw it nationwide, all of those pointless games. I don't like it as a fan. I follow Georgia Tech being here in Atlanta. I have absolutely no interest. I watched maybe two snaps of that Elon game on TV, but I watched the whole second half of that Georgia-Clemson game. So you see where I'm going with that. Spreading the field, rest of the nation. Big week for the FCS schools. Towson got a big win over UConn. Southern Utah over South Alabama, which I guess kind of counts. North Dakota State, a big win over Kansas State. People actually called that game. I think Stuart Mando and Lou Holtz, like I give them credit, they actually called that victory and put it out there in public. They're the two-time defending FCS champions, major players in that realm of football. Kansas State, obviously, without Colin Klein and a lot of their guys, they're rebuilding. But still, major win for them. Good job. Magnesi State over South Florida, 53-21. I like Willie Taggart. As I mentioned, he did a good job, a very good job, at Western Kentucky. That's a really bad loss for them to start off his tenure there with that loss. Northern Iowa, actually another solid FCS team over Iowa State. And then Eastern Washington over Oregon State. If you notice, a lot of these teams, like North Dakota State, Magnesi State, Northern Iowa, Eastern Washington, those are top 10 FCS teams. And then obviously you throw your Georgia Southerns out in there and a few other teams. But those are top 10 talents or top 10 teams as far as the FCS goes. And you got to be careful playing those teams. While the coaches can talk and motivate the players as much as they can, two factors are YC's first week upsets. One is the first week of the year, and that's repetitive, I know. You do as much practice as you do and how many two-a-days and scrimmages that you have out there, you don't know how your team is going to react when the real game actually starts. Even veterans that have been playing two, three seasons, you don't know how they're going to be. You're playing a lot of new guys, whether it's freshmen that are new to the program or guys who are on the bench and were reserves and now they're starting. You don't know how that's going to be as far as the actual play on the field. And then off the field, as I said, the coaches can motivate as much as they want and tell their players that these are tough teams, they're major, they're going to be really hard to face. All of those guys are in their dorm rooms or in their apartments in the mess hall or the whatever, saying, hearing all of the fans like, oh man, you're going to beat those guys. Eastern Washington, they're nothing on you. You know, we're the Beavers. Or Towson, where is Towson? We're Connecticut. We've been to the Fiesta Bowl. They're not going to put up a fight against us. And subconsciously, I think that really becomes a part of the issue. And then a third point, these are really good FCS teams. They're top 10 squads. Not everyone can go to Alabama, LSU, USC, Oregon. You know, you insert top 20 program here. A lot of those guys are very talented and ended up at those schools for a variety of reasons. Sometimes it's academics. Sometimes they're transfers from bigger programs and they want some playing opportunity. And then sometimes it's they want to really play for that school and they get playing time from their freshman year. They don't have to sit on the bench and at a bigger program, an FCS program or FBS program, and they are very talented and they're ready to go. So that's why I think you saw a lot of those upsets around the rest of the nation. I gave my prediction as far as South Carolina and Georgia. Notre Dame and Michigan, interesting matchup there. I think that one, you're going to see Michigan come out with the victory. Notre Dame, I didn't really learn much from their win against Temple. Temple's kind of fallen on some hard times relative to when Al Golden was there. I think in the end, you're going to see the Wolverines, especially with their quarterback, make some plays and get the win there. And the second week, you're slowly starting to see the juices flowing as far as some top matchups. And then the week after that is when you really get to pick up the college football. So those are my thoughts on what happened in the world of college football in my triple option attack. When we come back, I'm going to redo my verbal submission in my top five fighters in each major division in the world of mixed martial arts here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. Back to the podcast, host E. Marcel Portu. Interesting that we're doing an MMA or analysis right now on the podcast when fights are actually going on right now. With the addition of Fox Sports 1 to our sports media stratosphere, we're starting to see a lot more UFC events on Fox Sports, which is tremendous, but they're happening on random days, Tuesday and Wednesday nights, and I gotta record my show, so we're gonna record this as quickly as we can, or we're not. I'm gonna take my time and give you fans what you want, of course. But right when this finishes up, I'm gonna watch that Ryan Bader Glover Teixeira fight. By the way, I'm taking Teixeira, and that guy is a vicious fighter. Bader got some heart though; he's a tough fighter as well. But I think Teixeira is going to be too much for him to handle, especially in the clinch and when it gets to the ground. That's my quick thoughts on that UFC fight night taking place. All right, verbal submission, which is a fitting title given how the the Benson Henderson Anthony Pettis fight ended up. Usually we do passing the guard as well, just so you kind of know where we go with some of these names. I don't want to just do mixed martial arts review or college football recap or NBA analysis. I could give some nice snappy names to it, something easy for all of you to remember. And verbal submission is one of my favorite forms, one of my favorite things that happens in MMA. And also passing the guard, as a ground junkie as I am, I love seeing guys pass guard. So that's why we kind of go with those names. But verbal submission is how Benson Henderson actually lost his fight to Anthony Pettis. And we'll get to that fight when we get down to the lightweights power rankings. We'll start with the heavyweights. Not much has changed here. Cain Velasquez, UFC champion, still number one. Junior Dos Santos, number two fighter. They're going to fight each other, I believe, in a month or so in Houston. So that's going to put some settlement to there. I still have Daniel Cormier, number three, which is interesting because he's going to fight Roy Nelson in UFC 166 as a heavyweight, obviously. But then after that, I think he's going to try to step down to 205 and get his weight-cutting situation together. And for those of you not familiar with mixed martial arts and the Daniel Cormier situation, Olympic wrestler, when he tried to cut weight to fight or to wrestle in the Olympics, he had some, I guess, organ damage or organ failure. I believe it was the kidney that gave him trouble. So anytime he cuts weight, he has to be very careful with that. So he's really an undersized heavyweight fighter. But just with his ground game and his heavy hands, he's been able to keep an undefeated record in the heavyweight division. But I like to see that fight against Roy Nelson. Really interested in that. Finally, Josh Barnett's my number four, which is a big spike for him because he was barely in my top 10 probably 2 months ago. But he had a very impressive win against Frank Mir. The stoppage was a little short, but if you're going to have referees there, I'd rather them go on the cautious side than to see a guy just get pummeled and beaten up. The Mir argument is, of course, that because when the fight ended, he popped right back up. You don't put yourself in that position for the referee have to make you stop it. Barnett got a strike in. He weakened Mir. Mir fell down to the ground, and Barnett got another punch in. It looked like Mir was going out. And if that situation, if you cannot defend yourself, the referee must stop the fight. So I understand it. I'm a Frank Mir fan. I'm not a fan of many fighters, but Mir is, I'm very pro Mir camp guy. But with that fight, I understand the stoppage. I did not have a problem with it personally. But that puts Barnett in the top four. And he may be one or two fights away from fighting for the title, which, if you know his sordid history with the UFC, that'd be quite interesting. He was a former UFC heavyweight champion years ago. But after he won that, he left the UFC under some bitter terms and is finally starting to make his way back into it. Just missing out on the cut, Travis Brown, impressive win over Alistair Overeem, who I think the shine has really worn off of him. Came into the UFC as a hot commodity. Guy who looked like he had the heavyweight title look to him. Bad losses to Antonio Silva. And now to Travis Brown, he's not looking too hot right now. The chin, as big as he's gotten and physically improvements he's made and being a K-1 champion as far as kickboxing goes, his chin in defense has always been suspect. And when you face guys at this level of the UFC, they're going to take advantage of your defensive weaknesses. And you're starting to see that happen to Overeem. So Brown just missed he is in my top five. I guess he'll be number five in my fight rankings. Light heavyweight, still kind of the same as well. John Jones, number one. Rashad Evans, I have number two. Lyoto Machida, three. Phil Davis, four. And I'll put Gustafson at five. Alex Gustafson, who's going to fight John Jones in a few months for a light heavyweight title. I'm going to put him at number five. And Dan Henderson just outside of there. I know that Davis got that win over Machida. I saw the fight. Personally, I thought Machida did more to win the fight. So while normally when you do power rankings, you usually put the guy, unless it was either years ago or something really egregious, usually rank the guy who won ahead of the guy who lost. In this case, I'm still just looking at the body of work. I'm keeping Machida at three and Davis at four. Middleweight, biggest probably change since my last power ranking. Chris Weidman's number one, Anderson Silva number two. Now, this is another case where Weidman got the win, earned it fair and square. It was a clean win. But you can say, well, look at the body work of Anderson Silva. Should he still be number one? In comparison to Weidman's career, and to be fair, Weidman is still a younger fighter, not as many fights as Silva, who defended the belt for years. I still think in this case, though, you put Weidman at number one, and you keep Anderson Silva at a very, very close number two. And those two guys are going to fight each other at the end of the year, so that will be settled as far as who the top middleweight is. Rest of the division, Vitor Belfort, Mark Munoz, Michael Bisping, each of those guys have their strengths and weaknesses. You can kind of pick one out of a hat and put them in there. I really don't have a way to distinguish those next three between three to five, so I just put them in a group. Welterweight, George St. Pierre is number one, Johnny Hendricks number two. Really can't make an argument there as far as those two go. Carlos Condit, excellent win over Jake Ellenberger. I put him at a solid number three. Nick Diaz, I still have at number four. I know he's had a rough go the past few fights, but he's still, I think, a guy who is a top five fighter. And number five is Rory McDonald, who I really can make an argument at being number, putting him over Diaz. Now, Condit does hold a win over McDonald, so I respect that as far as the rankings go. But Rory McDonald's a guy who's moving up the charts very quickly. And then finally, light heavyweight, and we'll get that the main event from this past weekend as far as UFC goes. Anthony Pettis is your number one lightweight, without question. Excellent win over Benson Henderson. Ben came in the fight very strong. Maybe as looking from the outside in, he looked a little smaller than normal. I don't know if it was a weight cut issue, or he was not able to rehydrate. But relatively speaking, I thought Henderson looked smaller than he normally does. I'm being amateur fight doctor, fight analyst, but I thought that was a factor in what happened. And overall, Anthony Pettis was able to get some good punches in, good body blows, and got submission in. And he is the champion. I really want to see a rematch between those two. It's a tough division, though, because Gil Melendez, I think, he might have a case. TJ Grant, who is the odd man out. I don't like how Pettis requested to face Jose Aldo, which was actually supposed to be a fight happening originally. Because what happened is TJ Grant was supposed to fight Benson Henderson, and Anthony Pettis was supposed to be the featherweight fight against Jose Aldo. Well, TJ Grant got a concussion and was pulled out of the fight, and Pettis stepped back up into the lightweight division, faced Benson Henderson for the rematch of their fight. That happened the last fight at WEC about a year or two ago. So in the end, Pettis is now the champion. Now, does Ben Henderson get that rubber match? Possibly. Does Gil Melendez get a shot? Michael Chandler? Well, Mike Chandler's in the Bellator. He's my number five guy. That's probably not going to happen for a lot of reasons. But TJ Grant, I really want to see the Canadian get a shot at the belt. So we'll see what happens with that. Those are my thoughts on mixed martial arts world so far. And I think we touched on a lot of topics. If you have any comments or questions about it, or just want to tell me I'm way off of my rankings, please send me something on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, or send me an email at sportsinquirer@gmail.com. We always appreciate the fans or the listeners' interest and arguments. I'm always game to hear what you're thinking. Try to be very as much interactivity between us as I can. I'm going to take a next break here, and when we come back, we're going to do our zone blitz portion of the show, which means we're going to talk some NFL and get our preseason or regular season predictions here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. We'll be right back. back to the podcast, host E. Marcel Portu. Man, I love Little People. Tremendous new album from them, or their last album, We Are But Hunks of Wood. Tremendous, talented electronic group that I have really fallen in love with over the past few years. So I had to get some Make Me Better all in there for you. All right, so Zone Blitz, NFL predictions. I'm going to go through these relatively quickly. I'm going to have them put them up on the site probably later tonight or by tomorrow when the kickoff between Baltimore and Denver starts the NFL season. So we're going to go through the divisions first and playoff teams and then get some individual awards from there. All right, so AFC East, I think one of the easiest divisions to predict, second easiest one to another one, which we'll get to. New England's going to finish first. I know all the losses they've had in the offseason and the injuries, both on and off the field, Gronkowski being hurt a little bit and losing Wes Welker, Aaron Hernandez. We all know what happened there. Still the best team in that division. As long as you have Brady and Belichick still going strong, they're going to win that division pretty easily. Dolphins, number 2, Buffalo, 3, New York Jets, 4. I really rank those as far as my trust in the quarterbacks in each of those divisions. Each of those teams has some positives and negatives. But Ryan Tannehill, I trust a little bit more than E.J. Manuel, and I trust Manuel a little bit more than Geno Smith, Mark Sanchez, poo-poo platter of drama and garbage. That is the Jets, who arguably have, outside of Jacksonville, maybe the worst, and Cleveland's pretty down as well, maybe the worst rosters in the entire NFL. So Patriots win that division pretty easily. AFC North, I have the Bengals winning that division. A.J. Green thinks going to be a potential offensive player of the year. I think Andy Dalton makes that next step. And they have a top five defense that no one is talking about. Between Dunlap and Atkins in the front seven and the talented guys they have in the secondary, that's a nasty group that they have in Cincinnati as far as defensively. So I picked them to win. Ravens going to finish in second, be a playoff team, defending Super Bowl champs. Still have Joe Flacco, Ray Rice. I think the defense will be just good enough to be a wild card team, but you're going to see some drop off there. And outside of Ray Lewis and Ed Reed, obviously those two Hall of Famers leaving your roster is tough to deal with, but I think they'd be enough to be a wild card team. Pittsburgh, number 3, and Cleveland, number 4. Cleveland had a really good preseason. Brandon Wheaton looks like he'd made some steps as far as improvements, but just not enough to compete in that division. Pittsburgh, I just don't like Roethlisberger's health. Defensively, I think they're still starting to be, you're starting to see some hobbles in there. I know it's Pittsburgh. They're always going to be a solid team. I think this is the year that you really start, this might be a 6-10 season for the Steelers. And they've had those in the past and come back strong with the talented front office and drafting that they do. But I think this will be a year that they're really going to struggle. AFC South, Texans. I'm very bullish on the Texans, and you'll see with my Super Bowl picks and AFC picks overall. Indianapolis, number 2. Tennessee, 3, and Jacksonville, number 4. I like Indianapolis. I think Andrew Luck is a very solid player, but I think they're not going to have enough to make the playoffs again this year. Tennessee, I like seeing Chris Johnson run horizontally and not as much he's running up the middle a little bit more. I'm getting my horizontal and my perpendiculars and verticals confused, but I like what I'm seeing in the preseason from him. I think he's going to have a nice bounce back 1,400-yard season, but I think it's still not going to be enough because I don't trust Jake Locker very much. AFC West, Broncos win this division. I said New England's the easiest division to pick. Denver's pretty close, but I think they're going to get a little bit of a challenge from Kansas City, who's my number 2 team in the AFC West, and my second wild card. So my wild card's Baltimore and Kansas City. I like Andy Reid in a new situation. Alex Smith, I think, is a very good quarterback for this type of situation. They may have been the worst team with the most Pro Bowlers that I can think of in a long time. Look at their roster. You have Eric Berry, one of the top safeties in the entire NFL. Jamal Charles, top running back. You have Bo, solid wide receiver. They have talent on that roster. I don't know what happened with the Pioli era and just the total fallout from that, but they have the talent to be a pretty decent team, and I think they'll be one of those teams that finds a way to sneak into the playoffs. So my teams are New England, Cincinnati, Houston, and Denver winning their divisions. Baltimore and Kansas City as far as making a wild card. My AFC pick, I picked the Texans over the Broncos in the AFC Championship game. I think with J.J. Watt and the return of Cushing, that defense is going to be solidified. Ed Reed is, while he's not the Ed Reed of old, no one expects that. I think he's going to be enough to take care of that back four and be a solid leader back there and solid contributor. Offensively, Arian Foster, I think, still has another few good years in him. Andre Johnson, I think he's going to stay on the field this year, be pretty productive. Matt Schaub, another guy who's had injury issues that we all know about. I think he gets it together this year, and the Texans finally make that run to the Super Bowl. NFC East, picking the Redskins to win the East. A little bit of surprise there. I would say that if Robert Griffin III was completely healthy, and I think he will be eventually, like the first few games, and I don't care what you say about modern medicine, he's still going to have some issues. They are a dark horse Super Bowl team in the NFC East. If they make a run to the Super Bowl, do not be surprised. Number two, and the reason I pick Washington there, I think their defense is solid. Offensively, they have some good weapons. Robert Griffin III, obviously Morris in the backfield. They're gonna be a potential contender. Watch out for them. Number two, I have the New York Giants, who are my first wild card team. I know the secondary has a lot of injuries, but between Manning and Cruz and Nix, I think their offense is going to be enough to carry them to about 9 or 10 wins, and they're going to sneak into the postseason. Dallas is my number three team. I just don't know what you're going to get from your defense outside of DeMarcus Ware. Offensively, I think they'll be okay with Romo, obviously at quarterback. Dez Bryant's going to have a breakout season. If he keeps it together on and off the field, he's going to be an outstanding player. Jason Witten still gives you a lot of solid contributions at tight end. Running backs are getting a little bit injured, a little bit concerned about that. But I don't think they'll have enough to make a postseason run as far as Dallas because of their defense. Philadelphia is my fourth place team. I think Vic's going to have a pretty solid year in that Chip Kelly offense. But that defense has so many issues to work out from that wide nine disaster that they had under old coordinator Castillo. They're not going to have enough to be anything really in the regular season for the Eagles. NFC North, Green Bay is my number one. I think Aaron Rodgers is going to have, once again, another MVP caliber season. I think defensively they'll be a little bit better too. I like Clay Matthews, and I think Raji gets a little bit healthier. I think they're going to be a solid team defensively. Solid enough to win the division. Beyond that, I don't know. But they'll be doing enough. Chicago's my number two team. I like the hiring of the Mark Turgeon as far as the Mark Trestman, not Turgeon. I'm thinking he was Turgeon's Canadian name. He was with Canada with the Montreal Argonauts. But I like the head coach, Jay Cutler. I think he's going to have a bounce back season. It's a contract year for him, which is rare for a quarterback to reach. So I think you have to look out for him. Detroit, they're going to put up a ton of points. Reggie Bush is a nice addition, but they don't have enough on the defensive end. Despite the presence of Sue and Farrelly on the defensive tackles, it's not going to be enough. Minnesota, Adrian Peterson, best player in the game. Christian Ponder is not the best player in the game, and that's going to cause them some problems. NFC South, Falcons are number one. Offensively, they're going to be a top five team. Defensively, they may be below the middle of the pack. I think it evens out to a 10-win season, wins the division. New Orleans, kind of similar thing. Offensively strong, defensively, maybe the worst defense of the past 5-10 years were the Saints, especially against the pass defense. I know that Sean Payton doesn't play defensive back, and he doesn't play safety or linebacker, but I think his presence is going to be enough to make improvements there to finish second. Carolina, I like Cam Newton. They don't have enough weapons offensively to do much. Tampa's getting a lot of love as far as the bloggers go and the media as far as being a borderline playoff team. I just don't see it. I can see them finishing third or maybe even second to the Falcons, but I just don't see them being a playoff team. Right now I have them fourth. That may change within 24 hours after some more analysis. NFC West, San Francisco's, we'll get to them a little bit more when I get my NFC pick. San Francisco's one, Seattle is a bullish, strong number two with Russell Wilson, maybe the best defense in the entire NFL, especially on the secondary side of things. St. Louis is number three, and Arizona is number four. St. Louis I've seen a decent love for as well with Sam Bradford. I just don't trust him staying healthy. if he stays healthy, he has some decent weapons with Austin and some other guys, but I just don't see it happening for them. And my Super Bowl pick, for as far as the NFC team goes, I'm taking the 49ers. They have the most talented roster in the entire conference. Colin Kaepernick is only going to get better. I know losing Crabtree to the Achilles injury does hurt, but I think he'll find some other weapons to supplement that difference. Vernon Davis is going to, I think, have a really bigger impact on the offense than he did with Kaepernick towards the end of the season. Defensively, with the Smiths, Justin and Alton, Patrick Willis in the middle, they're going to cause trouble. I think overall they're going to be a Super Bowl team. And then my Super Bowl, I'm taking the 49ers over the Texans. So that's who I have as my Super Bowl pick. 49ers win the championship. MVP, I'm taking Aaron Rodgers. He's the best player in the game. And I mentioned Adrian Peterson's the best player. Aaron Rodgers is right there. But I think for MVP, he's going to get it. Tom Brady will be number two. Colin Kaepernick, three. Matt Ryan, four. I think Ryan has an outside shot to break the passing record all time, because that's what they're going to do. And I know Steven Jackson is there, and you're saying, well, they're going to run it a little bit more. Watch for a lot of swing passes out of the backfield for Steven Jackson from Matt Ryan. That's going to increase his passing numbers even more. And obviously having Julio Jones, Roddy White, Tony Gonzalez, as far as your receivers, helps tremendously. And Peyton Manning, I have number five, but we know how the media loves Peyton, so he actually might end up winning the whole thing. Coach of the Year, I'm taking Jim Harbaugh, number one. Andy Reid, number two, taking Kansas City to the playoffs. Mike Tomlin is going to be number three. And the reason I put Tomlin number three is Pittsburgh, I think, is going to suffer tremendous amounts of injuries, just the physicality of their play and the age of their players. But Tomlin is going to have them being a borderline playoff team all the way down to the last week. And he's going to put together his best coaching job since he's been with the Steelers. So I have him as third place for the Coach of the Year. Offensive Player of the Year, Adrian Peterson's number one. He's going to rush for 1,800 yards. Still going to have tremendous impact on the game. A.J. Green is going to be my number two. I really think you see him put together that 1,500 yard reception, 1,500 yards receiving type season. So I have him number two. Calvin Johnson is going to come, I don't think he's going to come close to 2,000 yards pass receiving again, but he's still going to have another excellent season. Drew Brees, number four. He's going to probably have the most touchdown passes out of all of the guys, so that's going to get him love there. And then Julio Jones, number five. I think he's going to have, once again, another breakout season, 1,400 yards receiving, maybe 10, 15 touchdowns. It's going to be a monster year for him. Defensive Player of the Year, I'm taking J.J. Watt. I'm not going to go with the broken product. 20-plus sacks from an interior lineman, that's crazy. That's what I swear for, especially for a 3-4 lineman. That's ridiculous. He's going to put up another stellar season. I'm going to pick him. And the Texans are obviously going to have a lot of wins. That's going to help his cause. Patrick Peterson, best cornerback in the game. I know Darrelle Revis is usually that guy, especially but with his injury coming back from that. Peterson's taking the mantle. He's the top dog. And he's going to return some punts and kicks for touchdowns with long yardage. That's going to help get his name out there. Clay Matthews, first half of last year, putting together a defensive MVP type year. Second half, not so much. I think he's going to put together a full season, be a top guy. Alton Smith, talk about he's one-dimensional. All he does is get sacks. Hey, if you give me 17, 18 sacks a season, I can work with that. He's my number four. And number five, Richard Sherman, cornerback for the Seattle Seahawks. Has a big mouth, got the Sports Illustrated cover. He's going to get some recognition and be in the top five. Offensive Rookie of the Year, Tavon Austin, St. Louis. These type of positions, it's the guy who gets the ball the most. And I think Austin's going to get the ball quite a bit. He's their main weapon in St. Louis. He's going to put up some highlights. He's going to be the top guy. Number two, Cordell Patterson, Minnesota. Watch out for him. He's going to get a lot of catches in the Minnesota offense, especially with their – I know they have Greg Jennings there, but Patterson is going to get some moments as well. Number three, insert running back here. We've seen it with Morris in Washington. Saw it with Doug Martin down in Tampa Bay. There's going to be that one running back that's going to put together a 1,500-yard season, and you're just shaking your head like, where did this guy come from? My pick right now is Giovanni Bernard from Cincinnati, but you can put in Monty Ball for Denver, Eddie Lacy, Green Bay. Joseph Randall, the Oklahoma State Cowboy, the former Cowboy, watch out for him with the new Cowboys as far as Dallas goes. He's going to get a lot of run there. But those are that's my offensive rookie of the years. Defensive rookie of the year, I'm taking Tyrann Mathieu, Arizona. Honey Badgers, we all know about the issues that he's had with on and off the field and all that fun stuff. However, he looks tremendous as a safety. I'm glad they made that move early and didn't put him at corner. He's going to cover slot, going to do some safety. He is going to have a major impact, get a lot of turnovers, and he's also going to return some kicks. And similar to Patrick Peterson, that's going to make him look even better as far as the voters go. So I pick him as Defensive Rookie of the Year. Star Lutulelei, Carolina, I thought was maybe the top guy in the entire draft last year until he had that little heart issue, which has been resolved, and that kind of worried me a little bit. But if that's been resolved, he is going to put up some good numbers and be a strong force for the Panthers inside the defensive tackle. Matt Elam, Baltimore, number three. All he's doing is replacing Ed Reed. So that means he's going to have plenty of opportunities to make an impact, get some picks, get some good return yardage. He's going to have a strong presence there as well. All right, we're going to take our final break. And when we come back, we're going to spread the field with some other news and notes in sports and then get to why selfies are ruffling my feathers here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. Quick break there. Welcome back to the podcast. Host E. Marcel Portute. Spread the field a little bit. Let's go to Europe. Arsenal finally signed a major player as far as the transfer window goes. If you listen to my last podcast, as an Arsenal fan in the English Premier League, I talked about the lack of spending financially by Arsene Wenger, the head coach, and the board of trustees. They made a major move, signed Ozil, the German midfielder from Real Madrid. Kind of a weird way how Tottenham actually helped Arsenal in this spot. With the signing of Gareth Bale from Tottenham over to Real Madrid, they really did not have this need the services of Ozil or Kaká. Kaká actually went back to Milan, went back to AC Milan, where he had some formidable years with the team there. So that opened up Ozil to be available to be picked up by Arsenal. Now, I don't know if Arsenal needed another midfielder, but he's a creative one. He actually does set up a lot of players and assist, and if he can make things easier for Giroud to score, I'm all for it. Arsenal's approach is a little bit different. They're not going to go with that straight number one striker. I mean, I guess Giroud's become that guy as far as the main striker, and he's started the season excellently so far. Even that Villa game, the first one that had everyone in panic and disaster, he actually played, I think, decently in that game. But midfield is always something that Arsenal can use. You always could use some more defense and everything like that, but this is a step in the right direction for the Gunners. Eric Burns, former outfielder for several teams, Arizona Diamondbacks, Oakland A's, he had some run, and I think a few other teams. He said that he was just talking to some former players, and he found out that a Hall of Famer, Major League Baseball Hall of Famer, used steroids during the 1970s and 1980s. While I don't appreciate the dry snitching, which means that you're pretty much telling somebody without telling on somebody, I understand the point that he's trying to make, and I've been saying this during the whole steroid situation with Major League Baseball. I don't understand if you're going to be indignant on performance-enhancing drugs and steroids, don't just limit it to guys in the 1990s or maybe the late 80s. If you look at the history of professional baseball, I guess I'm going to dry snitch a little bit now. If you look at the usage of amphetamines, usage of caffeine, and a bunch of other stuff, players have always been using a stimulant or a supplement to improve their form of play. Am I saying that's right? I'm not necessarily saying that's the right thing to do, But I don't think you could just put in a box all of the guys from the early 90s all the way to the early 2000s and say those are the only guys that use performance-enhancing drugs and just vilify them. And then you look at guys from the 60s, 70s, and 80s and said they were doing it the right way. If steroids were in the Olympic sports during that time and they were in professional football, and it's been well documented that it was in professional baseball. All of these athletes, and I'm sure all in some form of way you've dealt with an athlete at a high level, whether it's college, professional, it's a small world, especially when you come to trainers, nutritionists, and pharmacists. If football guys are using it, baseball guys know about it. If NHL, if hockey players know of a guy, you're pretty darn sure an NBA person is aware of it. If a weightlifter knows of somebody, trust me, a track and field athlete is familiar with that person as well. So I understand what Burns is saying, that you cannot just put these guys in a box or in a pocket from this certain era and not look at other ones. We'll get into that more in another episode. We're going to try to wrap things up a little bit quickly here. U.S. Open for tennis. During our show next week, we'll talk about the winners and losers overall. We're kind of towards the round of 16 quarterfinals of it. One of my biggest regrets as a sports fan, especially living in New York, is I never went to a U.S. Open event. I'm going to try to rectify that one year, try to get up to New York during the summer and actually attend an event. But you notice the presence of it in New York City when it's going on. You see a lot of people, especially from people from around the world, literally, on the 7 train and just all around New York City when the U.S. Open is going on. Tennis is maybe probably one of the most international sports because it translates to all regions of the world. And I always get interested in watching the late matches in New York, seeing the celebrities, and just seeing those diehards at 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night still watching all the matches. I love seeing that. I'm going to find my way up there one year to make that happen. And then finally, we're going to tie this down to Johnny Manziel. I did mention him in the college football section of when I was recapping everything. I think everything's been said and analyzed about him. Personally, I love the heel character that he's taking on. We didn't touch on professional wrestling this episode. Trust me, we'll get to it. WWE's doing my boy Daniel Bryan, or Bryan Danielson. They're doing him very wrong as far as the storyline goes. And we'll get into that next episode. But I do lighten the heel, for those of you unfamiliar with the terms. The heel, in essence, is the bad guy. The good guy is called a face or a baby face. He's the, and if you watch 10 minutes of wrestling, professional wrestling, you know what I'm talking about. Baby face is the good guy. The heel is the bad guy. So, in essence, I think Manziel is kind of with the taunting penalty and doing a little the autograph signing gesture and a little money thing. It is what it is. He knows he's looked at as a bad guy, and he's just using it to fuel his fire. I enjoy it personally. If I was his head coach, I may not as much, because he may lose focus on the task at hand. But as I said, individually, as a fan of sports, and then someone who's a fan of wrestling, I love what he's doing. He needs to embrace it even more. And I thought Texas A&M really messed up having him on the sideline for the first half of that game against Rice. They should have had him in the locker room, and then the second half, he emerges from the tunnel to the cheers of the crowd, maybe get some smoke going, get some music playing. That's how I would have done it, just an ultimate FU to the NCAA, and just show how much they got away with pretty much larceny of him only suspended for one half of a game for what the accusations and charges were. So I enjoy the new Johnny Manziel and want to see more of it throughout this entire season. All right, we're going to wrap the show up with What's Ruffling My Feathers. One thing that I've tried to do over the past few months is work out a little bit more often. I'm 32 years old. I am overweight. If you've seen pictures, you can see that I need to improve some things in my body. And it's a lifelong issue that I've dealt with. And I just want to be healthy and be a productive individual as I get older. Part of that is going to the gym and working out. Got a gym membership. I like to go there, get my health taken care of, you know, get my lifting in, my cardio, steam room, the whole deal. Part of that, obviously, is the physical health and making sure that my body is right to live, literally. But also part of it is to improve my body as far as physically. I like to lose weight, get my body right. And not necessarily to impress women or to have a six-pack to show off to everybody. But physically, you like to look better. I've never reached a point, though, where the self-portrait or the selfies has come into play. After working out 2 days ago, I got a good lift in. I went to the steam room or the sauna or whatever you want to call it. Got a good sweat in. I walk out and I see a grown-ass man, shirt off. He had pants on, thank goodness, doing a self-portrait in the mirror in the locker room. Now, if you're some 14-year-old kid or some 18-year-old guy trying to impress your girlfriend and doing that type of thing, even that I question. But we've all been young and vain and selfish and think that's cute. I can give you a little bit of a pass. But if you are a grown man in your 40s, this man was older than me, and you're taking self-portraits, shame on you. And I know some of you out there are saying, well, if he has a good body, he should show it off. Or maybe he was doing a before and after type deal. And I've done those. We've all done that as well. You take a picture before you start working out. And then after you finish 6 months from now or whenever, you take another picture, compare and contrast. Those are done by somebody else. And you're in with a blank background, a wall or something like that. That's not done with the mirror in front of you so you can pose and make sure your angle is right. He was doing this to show off to his boyfriend or his girlfriend, or put it on his Instagram to be all cute and try to be like, oh, look at me, I'm at the gym working hard and going 100%. You're a grown man. Have some self-respect. And then I know another thing you're saying. Hey, Marcel, if it was a woman in her bikini or in the bra and panties, you'd be all over that and excited too. While I appreciate seeing a beautiful woman in not much clothing, I think any man who is a heterosexual enjoys that situation, or women who are lesbians find that intriguing as well. I still don't need to see that as well. Keep that to yourself. And do I go online and sometimes see a picture of someone that's the selfies of some beautiful women? Absolutely. Have I received a picture? Absolutely. That's okay, I guess. And if that's being sexist or me not being fair about it, so be it. I just do not need to see a grown man who is in his 40s or barely any hair trying to take self-portraits with his cell phone. And then if you're going to do it, don't do the one with the mirror. If I see another self-portrait with somebody in the back and with the mirror in the background, that's just very frustrating. And on the third point I'm going to make, you're saying, hey, Marcel, if he had a good body, let him do it. Or if it was a woman, let him do it. If you had that body, would you do that? Now, I'm not saying I have a six-pack or anything like that. I'm not embarrassingly terrible, shirt off. But I like to keep that to myself. And I'm not going to take a picture and send it out to half of the world like this guy was. Now, if my girlfriend wanted to see a little something, I'll just head over to the house and make it happen. That's how you do it. You don't send a picture. And don't even get me started on the privates or the genital pictures. That's just another level of wrong. If you're receiving or sending those, that's a definite shame on you. And fellas, if there's a girl out there that sends you those pictures, as far as her in her naked state or little clothing, don't send a response. They don't like that. So the message to that guy and all of you out there that think you're cute and think that you're slick, trying to take these self-portraits and self-pictures and send them out to your mate, or put it on your Instagram or your Facebook or your Twitter, or you're even doing some Vine video, take a pass on that, because I don't want to see it. And 99% of the time, the person that you're trying to send it to doesn't want to see it either. All right, thanks once again for listening to the Sports Inquirer podcast. It's been a pleasure talking to all of you out there. Over the next few days, we're going to have our mixed martial arts power rankings, our NFL predictions, and we're going to do our show next week. I don't know what the schedule is yet. Continue to check the site for constant updates on what we're going to be doing over the next few days. And on Twitter, we're under Sports Inquirer, all one word. Send me an email at sportsinquirer@gmail.com. Also on Facebook under the Sports Inquirer, or just look me up by my name, Etienne Marcel Portu. Find me there as well. LinkedIn also. Connect with me any way that you can. Until then, all of you have a safe and productive rest of the week. Enjoy the kickoff to NFL season. And until next time, good fight, good night.